Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet 104.6 FM. Shalom, Lenny.
Shalom, beautiful.
Well, we have in the studio this morning Lenny Blocksberg, the unusual Lenny. And I want to ask Lenny something about himself. You know, he's had a very varied number of careers. He is a good speaker, he's a good talker, and so I want to find out the essential, Lenny. So, Lenny, tell me something about your childhood. Where were you brought up?
I wasn't.
You brought yourself up.
Well, part of what's unusual, I guess, about me is I guess I never had a childhood as anyone would understand it. So,
explain.
Well, I was born, when my family lived in a tenement block in Newark, New Jersey, just across the river from New York City. And my family took me to Irvington General Hospital to be born. Or took my mother at the time, actually. I wasn't there yet. I was sort of like in being carried along. And the reason was because they wanted a family friend, Dr. Leonard Tushna, to deliver me. Now, Dr. Leonard Tushna is a doctor who was... He was a prisoner in the concentration camps in the Holocaust. And he basically did some work there that defined our modern concept of biomedical ethics. So there was a big issue when they at the end of World War II about what to do with the quote-unquote medical research done by the Nazis. And it was Dr. Leonard Tushna who provided the solution for that at the trials and the international hearings. So Dr. Leonard Tushna, in the camps, practiced as a doctor, caring for the people in the camps and providing the best palliative care he could with what limited resources he had. But he also told all the other colleagues, doctors that were working with him, that they needed to keep impeccable notes about what happened to people, because someday the medical information that came out of understanding how people, human bodies are affected by trauma, would be useful, okay? And they did it under a level of biomedical ethics that would be considered excellent on the best of what we have today. And at the end of the war, he published a whole bunch of papers about this, and his work became the basis of how we treat people who are found buried in rubble from earthquakes with extreme deprivation for long periods of time, because you could never subject a human being to that level of trauma to do an experiment. But the thing that really changed our concept of biomedical ethics was when they looked at the work that the Nazis had done, and they asked, what else could we do? Dr. Leonard Tushna came forward and said, you could have done this. And he showed his work, and he showed the ethical parameters that he worked under, and the ethical parameters that he held his team to, the standards he held his team to. And basically, on the basis of Dr. Leonard Tushna's testimony and the body of work, they wrote what we now, the basis of our now biomedical ethics rules, which is that you can only work to help people. You can never work to harm people. What you do has to be in the best interest of the patient. And
which is a Hippocratic Oath.
Very, very much so, yes. It's very consistent with the Hippocratic Oath, which is why it rang true with everyone. And if it's not done that way, then it's not medical research. So, in fact, what the hearings ruled is that as a biomedical researcher, remember I worked for 25 years as a biomedical research scientist, if I find something that of potential value in the Nazi work, I cannot even cite it as a reference. If I so much as cite that work as a reference, I lose the right to apply for public grant funding for any of my work ever again, and I lose the right to publish in any scientific journal ever again. So I can put in a note saying I read something in the Nazi literature saying this, and based upon that I designed a new experiment to test this properly, and here is what we found. And here are my references with proper, legitimate biomedical science. That's appropriate. Okay? That all came out of Dr. Leonard Tushna's
And why did research. Your parents choose him?
He was a personal family friend. And he also wrote science fiction, and I have several of his books in my personal library at home. And so I was born in a hospital in a town I never lived in. Okay? But that doesn't answer your question about where I grew up. So you asked where I was born. There's a story to everything. So basically, I kind of wound up having to grow up fast.
What, did you have siblings?
Yes. I had a sister, Judy, who was 2 years older than me, and a brother, Carl, who's 2 years younger. And my earliest memories are I was 3 and Carl was 1 and Judy was 5. And we were living in this big brick apartment block. And there was a playground in the park across the street from our apartment block. And I remember my father would go to work in the morning, and then my mother would put us out to go play in the park as soon as he left the house. And when my father came home, I have lots of memories of looking up at the apartment block from the playground, wishing we could get back in, but we were locked out for the day. And when my father came home, we would be crying, huddled against the door, waiting to come in, having had nothing to eat and no access to the toilet all day long. And again, I was three, my brother was 1, in these images in my head, and my sister Judy was 5. And I know a lot of growing up was kind of like that. And when I was 4, that mother abandoned me. And it was the 60s, and she wanted to go, I want to find myself. And so she went to find herself. And my father picked up a gun and threatened to commit suicide. And I remember talking him down from that, and we got in the car, and it was the stereotypical pouring rain at night. My father crying. His eyes were more blurred from the tears than the rain on the windscreen. And my sister Judy and my brother Carl in the back seat and me sitting next to my father, basically talking to him and trying to coach him that we were going to be all right.
How old were you?
I was 4. At that point, I basically...
Grew up?
Well, I kind of grew up a lot before that because, as I said, I'd spent my years growing up being put out in the park and told, fend for yourself, kids. I've got better things to do. But that was for me a real seminal moment of, I've basically got to pull the britches up and take care of things. And my father was an interesting guy. He had a lot of mental health issues, but he was also basically a high-scoring genius. The kind of people that make gifted and talented people look stupid, okay? And the combination meant that I think one of the most frustrating things for him was the fact that he was intelligent and aware enough to understand and appreciate how insane he was. And I'm not sure if you can imagine the pain of being conscious of how mentally ill you are. It's totally different when you're mentally ill and you're just simple and you don't know it. Mm-hmm. But when you actually have the cognitive awareness of it, it's really scary and profound. So I wound up spending a lot of time taking care of my dad and my family.
He had no other family.
Well, his parents, and they did tremendous things. So I know you're not supposed to say a yard site for your grandparents, but I say a yard site for my grandparents, because they played a huge role in our upbringing, and they were always our fallback, and they were always there for us.
That's his parents.
His parents. Her parents, I have no memory of. I have memories of her, but no memories of her parents. We wound up, he was incredibly talented as a tool and die maker. Nobody knows what a tool and die maker is. So if you've ever picked up a plastic spoon, okay? Before that plastic spoon was made in a machine, somebody had to carve that plastic spoon in reverse by hand into a block of steel. Okay? Well, all that's done by hand because the first machine, the tooling, is hand-carved in reverse. So that then you've got a mold that you can make thousands of them with a machine. Great. Who's the guy who does that hand-carving? And never thought about the skills and involved in that, where you're hand carving to tolerances of plus or minus, sometimes down to a millionth of an inch. In his day, it was all inch. An easy project was just down to a 10,000th of an inch. That was really crude and simple. But the tough ones were millionths of an inch. And he was incredibly talented. And so he always had people wanting to work for him. But because he was unstable, he never had people wanting him to stay. And so we were always being thrown out of this place or that. And he was always looking for work and paid well when he got something and thrown out as quick as they could. But nobody wanted him anymore.
And you had to move all the time?
We moved so much. I had a running joke with my dad, running argument with my dad. I told him that we lived in Maine for 2 weeks. He said, no, we were on holiday in Maine for 2 weeks. We just took everything with us and went to a different home and went back. But the thing is that we moved so often that you couldn't tell the difference. Okay? But at 6 years old, I was giving my dad a what for about the fact that we needed food in the house and the kids needed something to eat. And so he said, fine, you get a job. So the reason I started working in 1968 is because, well, I started my first company because nobody hires six-year-olds. So I had to get a job to feed my brothers and sisters. That was life. Couldn't earn a lot of money, so I studied wild foods and
At six,
well...
Where did you go to school?
Often wherever we could. But the school didn't matter because most of the time we lived in poor neighborhoods and we moved around so much that I could never count on the schooling matching up. So I basically just went to yard sales and garage sales and picked up old university textbooks for 10 cents and read those and said, screw the teachers, don't care.
But somebody had to teach you to read.
No. Nobody taught me to read. If anybody taught me to read, it would have been my grandparents. Some of my early childhood memories are when I was 2 years old. I remember my father reading me he had gone to university for world economics. And he was reading me his economic theory books and his global philosophy textbooks. So we would read Nietzsche and Kant and Aristotle and Plato, and we would read Engels, Feuerbach, and Douglas Adams, or John Adams, and all the great economists and economic theorists and all the great philosophers. And my grandparents as well would read this to me. And I remember when I was 2 years old, sitting there, and my mother downstairs yelling, when I was sitting there up there having this lovely conversation with my dad about the passages in his economics textbooks. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Will you let the kid go to sleep already? He's only 2 years old, and that's the part of it that I remember that I was 2 years old at the time, because this is the screaming from my mom. She's only 2 years old. It's 2 a.m. Will you let the kid go to sleep already? But that's what I grew up on. And so I guess when I was about 5 years old, I kind of rebelled and found Charlotte's Web, and I read that because I'd grown up reading philosophy and global economic theory, which was all quite interesting. But, you know, that's...
Not as entertaining.
Well, I guess not. But at the time, I grew up very focused on what was functional. You know, I mean, I say when I was six, my father told me to fine, go get a job. When I was five, I remember my new stepmother came home from the hospital with a new baby. And she and my dad went out to party. And the kids were hungry. And there was no food in the house. Just some ingredients. So I learned to cook. And my first attempt at cooking was really, really terrible. I did a really bad job.
And your sister?
Well, she was only 7 years old. And she really wasn't at that point mature enough to be able to read cookbooks and figure things out like that. Whereas for me, since I'd been reading university textbooks in chemistry and science and stuff like that that interested me, the kids brought me a candy wrapper, and I basically did a full chemical analysis on it and did this is actually my first attempt at cooking. They brought me a candy wrapper. I read through the ingredients. I knew that the ingredients were listed in orders of amounts. I looked up chemical equivalents for all the different things in there. We put it together. We put it in the oven, and it was slime. And it was terrible. So I got a cookbook. I said, this is embarrassing. Okay, I am not doing this a second time. The next thing I make, they're going to like it. And by golly, they did. And I cooked for them, and I took care of them when I was 5 years old. You know, my brother Gabe came home from the hospital, and that day mom and dad went out to party, and my sister Judy and I warmed the bottles and changed the nappies.
And the stepmother didn't look after her own child
Gone. You know, party time. We were left at home for days, weeks at a time. So I became their other dad, and my sister Judy became their other mom. And at first it was like, for Judy, it was like, this was like the ultimate baby doll. It was real. It was alive. But it was real poo, and it was really hungry, and there was no real food, you know? And it was real hard. So this is me at 5 and me at 6 finding a job. So you ever wonder why I'm a little bit strange? Well, I never had those years of doing those things. I was supporting a family. I mean, I grew up, I remember harvesting wild foods. I knew where every plant that was going to be edible was in the forest, a bush around my house. I knew when it was going to come ripe, and I was out there picking it and making sure that I made something for my family to eat.
So you had bush around the house.
It was always green belts, okay? Wherever we lived, it didn't matter. As soon as we go into a place, I'd find that green belt, and I knew where things were, okay?
And who planted the food, or they were...
Well, the stuff, wild stuff grows in the bush.
Right.
And I studied wild foods.
That were edible.
Yeah. And, you know, every once in a while, I remember there'd be like a black sack dropped on the doorstep. And we have no idea where it came from, but it'd be like rags in it. And so I would get the black sack, and it was my job to sew stuff that the kids could wear to school. So we had clothes to wear. And I would work and earn money and buy clothes for them to wear. And
what did you do to earn money?
Anything I could.
But what? You know, who hires 6-year-olds and,
well,
7-year-olds?
If you're so 6 and 7-year-olds can go out and do yard work and garden work, and that's pretty good. I could be a good shoe shine boy, a paper delivery boy. You know, I did fur trapping. Trapped furs. That was great, because what you do is you catch the animal, you skin it, and you make a stew out of the animal, and you feed the family with that. And
what fur?
Doesn't matter, any kind of fur. Don't care. I'll catch anything, and if they'll give me a couple dollars for it, I'll sell it. Don't care. The best one was the eastern water rat, or what was called a muskrat. So muskrat fur is the exact, it's a very close relative of mink. So the fur characteristics are exactly the same as mink, only it's a different color. So if you buy a coat that says real fur, and it looks like mink, but it doesn't say real mink, I can guarantee you it's a rat. Okay? Because if it's mink, they put real mink fur. If it's real fur, and it looks like mink, and it feels like mink, it's muskrat dyed to look like mink. And I know this because I used to trap the little buggers.
Where do they live? In the green belts?
They live in the rivers and channels and the canals that run around in the upper northeast. And they're a big rat, and they might be the body would maybe be 40 centimeters long, 30 to 40 centimeters long. And they have a tail, which is flat when it's standing up, almost like a fin. They can use it like a fin swimming through the water. It's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Now, normal rat tails are round. This is sort of flat. It's actually diamond-shaped in cross-section, but it looks flat from the side. Yeah.
So you became an expert on that.
I don't know about an expert, but I did that for a while. And basically anything I could do to earn money. I was up before dawn, and I was working until 2 o'clock in the morning to try to do something whatever I could.
Didn't your father realize that, you know, he wasn't contributing towards the upkeep of the children at all?
My father did everything he could to contribute to the upkeeping, okay? But he wasn't always able to. So there were two problems. First of all, he was in and out of jobs very frequently. Actually, three problems. First of all, he was in and out of jobs very frequently. Okay. Second of all, he generally picked women based on their boobs and their party favors. Okay. So let's just say they weren't really encouraging the household maintenance sort of type ladies. And the third thing was that his concept of financial responsibility was very different. So I remember an example of his idea of financial responsibility. My brother Carl, when he was in high school, managed to get one of these petrol station credit cards, which they would give people to get started on a credit rating. And my father convinced him to let him borrow it. So my brother Carl gave him the card to borrow it so he could put petrol in the car. And my brother Carl gets a letter that he's now $3,000 in debt. And my dad says, oh, it's okay, don't worry, I left town, nobody will know about it. And that was his kind of idea of financial responsibility. So he worked really hard. I mean, given the circumstances we grew up in, it's he did amazing things to take care of us, okay? But it was hard times, and there were lots of kids, and, you know, I mean, we started out with my father and my first mother with three kids. He married to a woman who had one kid already. She had gotten pregnant when she was 15, and the parents threw her out of the house, and the guy promised to marry her and then took off and left town and left her holding the bag and the bills for the wedding. And so she married some guy who took her in. This is my second mother, stepmother. And she married this guy who took her in but hated kids. And when she had the audacity to get pregnant on him, he beat the crap out of her and threw her out. So then she had two kids, and she met my dad, and he took her in and took care of her. And those two, Wesley and Lisa, became my new brother and sister. So now we have five kids from two mothers and three fathers. And then they had two more kids together, which was Gaby and Tracy. So now we have seven kids from two mothers and three fathers by four combinations. And then, of course, that didn't work out, and my father remarried a woman who had five kids.
What happened to the second woman's kids? Did she?
They stayed with us.
She didn't take them.
No, when she left, she went off on her own, and basically the kids stayed together. We were a unit. Nothing was going to separate us, and so it was a funny. You know, we didn't want any of the government agencies to find out about anything that was happening to us, because at the time, they would have split us up and sent us off to separate homes. So we did everything we could to stay together. But of course, there were more kids than that, because we took in foster kids and stray kids. Now, stray kids are when you're living in some of these neighborhoods that we were in, and you have homeless kids that come to your house because you're a safe house. You have kids that have might be gay, and their parents might kill them if they stayed home, and they come to our house as a safe house. So I had dozens of brothers and sisters. There are seven that I keep in touch with.
Did they contribute at all? Did they help you? Did you teach them also skills?
We worked on it together. The original seven, we are a cohesive unit. We still stay in touch. We recognize each other as brothers and sisters.
And they managed to go to school and to high school and so on.
And the other ones that came and went, well, yeah, whatever. Some of them we don't, some of us will talk to some of them, but we don't really keep in touch as a unit sort of thing. So there's probably maybe 25 kids, 30 kids in there total. And my father did great work to try to take care of us, but there was just not a lot he could do. And I wound up being their other dad. And so I took care of everybody, and that's how I grew up. So when I answer the phone, how may I serve? Well, I don't know anything else. Mm. And I always try to be self-reliant, because for me, my family knows that if I ever need to ask for help, it won't matter, because I'm always last man standing. there'll be no one left.
So when did you leave that?
I ran away from home to go to university after I graduated high school.
So when did you start high school? Because you didn't go to primary school.
Well, I did attend schools. I went in and out. But the thing is, it was like, well, whatever. You go to school and whatever the teacher's doing, don't care. And went to high school, same thing. Don't care. So I just moved on. And that's what I did. I went to university, and it was on my own. I didn't have to take care of anybody anymore. But my dad would call me up and tell me that the family needed money. And so as a university student, I mean, I thought I was rich because you got high-paying work-study job, you know?
Oh, you could get help to go through university?
I got financial aid. I got in trouble with the financial aid office because my family was so poor that our financial aid contribution came out negative, and that's not supposed to be physically possible. And they got called in and got audited, and when they realized that it was real, they almost cried. But they just said, they were literally practically in tears and just sending me off to go on my way and make the best of it. I wasn't supposed to exist.
So do you stayed home while you went to university?
No, in the U.S., you usually live in the dormitories at the university. Mm-hmm. That's the normal thing there. My father was really terrified to lose me because he knew how much I was doing, but he called me up every couple of weeks and would ask me to send money home. And being that I was so rich on a student stipend, I mean, I could have plenty of money to send home.
Did any of your brothers and sisters sort of rise up to help as you used to?
No. And they never, it wasn't until many, many years later, and I was home visiting from New Zealand. Okay, and I was visiting there, and I asked to borrow a car, and I paid for the petrol in it, and I paid for, when everyone went out to dinner, I paid for dinner, and then suddenly they all looked at me and said, wait a minute, you always pay. And they suddenly realized that I had always taken care of them and always paid for everything, and I never asked for anything in return. And all of them got together, and they won't let me pay for anything ever again. But it was not until I was like in my 40s that it finally dawned on them. That I never asked for anything.
And they all stayed in touch with each other.
Oh yeah.
Do they live near each other?
They all do. I'm one that's out there.
So which is how come that you left, and you left the country? And you've only got 3 minutes.
How come I left? Just following my career, and it's where it took me. And yeah.
Well, Lenny, I can see it like a movie.
But I haven't told you any of the details yet.
We've had half hour today, but we have booked some more time so that we can expand on the next stage and what made you go and what did you study and how does it affect what you're doing now? And why did you choose New Zealand? Minutes to tell me why you chose New Zealand.
I wasn't paying close enough attention to the location line on the job ad. I don't know. They were looking for talent. They got me instead. I got headhunted over here. They were recruiting talent for a new biotech company. I was a postdoc, and I decided I wanted to take an exciting job doing something more interesting, and they really sounded exciting. And so I took the job.
So you also looked for excitement.
I guess so.
Well, thank you, Lenny. I look forward to the next episode of the serial. And thank you for coming, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10 to Radio Shalom. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom, one word. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.